follow on from our spinal trauma episode, I sat down with Professor Seamus Morris. Professor Morris is a consultant trauma orthopaedic and spinal surgeon, currently based in the National Spinal Injuries Unit at the Mater Hospital. He also works at Kappa National Orthopaedic Hospital and the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Dunleary. He is clinical professor of surgery at University College Dublin and course director for the MSc in Primary Care, Orthopaedic and Musculoskeletal Medicine. Professor Morris is a specialist in complex trauma and spinal surgery. After graduating from UCD, he completed a basic and higher orthopaedic specialist training in RCSI before a fellowship year in complex spinal surgery in New York and subsequently St George's Hospital in London. He has served on numerous trauma course faculties, including the recent European trauma course. Needless to say, he's well published both nationally and internationally on trauma and spinal surgery. And as one of my previous consultants on my spinal orthopaedic rotation, I felt he might be a good one to put a few of my more controversial spinal questions to. However, I have to admit that I had some technical difficulties on my end and the remote audio quality is sketchy at best because I was recording in my brother's attic. We've made the best of a bad situation and hopefully you get the good parts. The show notes will be up on the website. Professor Morris, it's a pleasure to have you on the Case Dot Report. Thanks for joining us. I thought maybe if you wanted to, you might tell us a little bit about yourself and when you got interested in spine.
Yeah, so my name is Seamus Morris. I am a consultant orthopedic spine surgeon in the National Spine Injuries Unit in the Mater. Been a consultant spine surgeon, I suppose, for coming up on 15 years now. I was actually an intern in the spine unit way back an awfully long time ago. So I was exposed to spine injuries really at the very start of my medical career. And they're really challenging cases, really interesting cases. And obviously, if you can do something to help these patients who have really devastating injuries, it can make a massive difference to their life. So I was kind of drawn to it from the get-go. In terms of, I suppose, my practice as a spine surgeon and all our practices as spine surgeons in the Mater, we cover the broad gamut of things. The spine injuries component is just one part of it. So it's an immensely interesting field. It's a field that's constantly changing and has changed throughout my career and continues to change, most recently with robotics and spinal navigation. So it's a really interesting area to work in, and spinal injuries is one very interesting part of that.
And I think it's also that, especially with the trauma centres, having spine such an integral part of that, but also managing major polytraumas as well from the orthopaedic side. So we had chatted earlier, I suppose, on our previous one about kind of the assessment of the complex spinal trauma patient. I'd kind of love to get your input on that and how you kind of go about, you know, approaching the patient when they come into the department. It's very emergency medicine based at the moment, but you may have a different approach that might be interesting to hear.
Well, I suppose the same old ABCs apply as per ATLS, you know. So once you've got the life-threatening injuries out of the way and the patient is stabilized from that point of view, then I suppose then the spine may or may not be the most significant injury that they have. And I suppose the principles behind managing a spinal cord injury is there's nothing any of us can do about the primary injury the patient has suffered at the time. And everything we're really trying to do is to prevent secondary injury to the remaining neurons around that area that are questionable, I suppose, in terms of their viability. And really the principles behind that are the same, really, I suppose, as drive all trauma care. We're trying to maintain optimal oxygenation and perfusion of that area. So from an ED point of view, airway and breathing are really critical for these patients. I suppose it depends on the level of the spinal injury in terms of the need for intubation of these patients. Obviously, a higher cervical spine injury, they may need very urgent intubation because they're going to go off very rapidly. A thoracic injury, they may be transferred from another center to the major trauma center of the spinal unit, self-ventilating and require ventilation after surgery for a lengthy period of time may frequently require tracheostomies. The other issue then is maintaining adequate cord perfusion, and there's substantial amount of evidence really that maintaining mini arterial pressure of over 85 millimeters of mercury is really a driving factor that, you know, we can look after from the ED perspective. And then the final thing outside oxygenation or perfusion is trying to decompress the cord as quickly as possible. So it's those three planks really that we're focusing everything on to try and improve patient care. So obviously a lot of the principles we use in terms of managing trauma in general are applicable to those. I know that's kind of, I don't know if that answers specifics, but it's why every time, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I suppose just having that approach is always helpful regardless, even if it is, you know, a higher spinal cord injury than you are thinking early intubation and whether there's diaphragmatic involvement. Should I mention the word steroids?
For steroids in modern spine practices, I'm sure you're familiar with the NASA study, which were 10 years ago maybe or so, and the pendulum is swung very much against steroids at the moment in terms of there's no real evidence to support their benefits in terms of long-term outcomes. And there's a fair preponderance of data suggesting they increase the risk of infection, issues like stomach ulceration, et cetera. So there's no real role for steroids in acute spinal cord injury, certainly at the present time, unless there's more data coming out down the road. That's things that moment.
A lot of these patients, when they come in, they basically go straight to CT, depending on where you are. If they come back from CT and there is, you know, a diagnosis of a spinal cord injury or a suspicion of a vertebral fracture, at least, you know, obviously these get discussed with orthopedics very quickly, but when do you think they should be getting an MRI? Is it, you know, if you're kind of in a peripheral center that maybe not have great access, should we be pushing to get an MRI, or when do you think they need it?
If there's spinal cord injury, we're going to need an MRI scan. And the reason, I suppose, from a spinal center point of view is obviously it's going to show us the soft tissues much more clearly. So things we're looking at from that point of view in the cervical spine, we're trying to see, do they have a prolapsed disc that's into the canal? That may change our mechanism of management away from closed reduction to doing a direct open decompression and stabilization in that patient cohort. We're looking to see, is there an epidural hematoma that we'd need to evacuate? And I suppose we're looking to see to the extent of the posterior ligamentous complex, if that's damaged or not. And that's a major factor in terms of determining spinal stability or not. So I suppose the real question is it going to delay patient management? So if it's a thing that, you know, you're going to wait 4 hours for an ambulance to come, which is unfortunately often the case, and you get an MRI scan expeditiously in that time, that would be fantastic. But if it's a thing the ambulance is literally waiting outside the door and you get them transferred and we've accepted care in the National Spinal Injuries Unit, well, then to keep things moving along is really the critical thing. So the factors that seem to make a difference is early surgical decompression. The Stasis trial showed that surgery within 24 hours significantly improves patient outcomes. So patients have improved two AIS grades who have surgery within 24 hours. 20% of those patients improved two AIS grades versus 8% who had surgery, delayed surgery. Now, 24 hours, I might say, is a blunt time point, but there's lots of animal studies, which obviously you can control variables much more aggressively. And again, in principle, the sooner you can decompress a damaged spinal cord, the better the patient's outcome. So these are our patients. We will take the theater in the middle of the night to decompress them, to give them a chance. So timing is really critical.
You were mentioning about stability. Would you be able to explain in terms of ligaments, the three complexes?
Different concepts, I suppose, in terms of spinal stability. And truth be told, even as surgeons, we argue amongst ourselves that this is essentially our area of expertise, and we still argue ourselves as to what's stable or not. The structures stabilizing the spine are the anterior and posterior longitudinal ligaments, which, as we know, run up and down the anterior and posterior aspects of the vertebral body, and the posterior ligamentous complex, which are the interspinous and supraspinous ligaments. So you have three ligamentous complexes. And then from a bony point of view, the vertebral body in the front and the facet joints in the back. So they're divided into columns. So if two of the three columns are damaged, the spinal column is said to be unstable. Now, that can be difficult to identify. An MRI scan is useful to look at the ligaments. And to be honest with you, we use a score called the thoracolumbar injury classification called TLIX, which I'm sure many of the EM community are familiar with. For those who don't use this frequently, and you guys obviously look after head injuries as well, I don't know if you're familiar with the NeuroMind app. It's a fantastic resource. So it has every scoring system you can possibly think of, TLIX, anything you care to remember, every classification for spinal injury, head injury, etc., is there. So if you struggle to remember these little nuances, I really recommend the NeuroMind app. It's free on the App Store. So anyway, the TLIX score is really what we use nowadays. And that breaks things down into three dimensions. One, the extent of the bony injury, going from a wedge fracture, which is obviously, you know, one, I think, through to a fracture displacement, which would be a three. Posterior ligamentous complex injury, absent, indeterminate, or complete, and the presence or absence of a neurological injury. So four is really the watershed. If you have a score of four, it's down to surgeon's choice. If you have a score of more than four, your spine is deemed unstable and you probably should have surgical intervention. If your score is less than four, you're probably a candidate for a brace. So the TLIX kind of simplifies things a little bit. It's somewhat more robust than kind of trying to put a finger in the air and work out it's two or three cups.
Then I suppose you kind of had mentioned the AIS score. I thought you might be able to kind of talk us through where it kind of came from and then I suppose the pros and cons to it, because I think when I was on it, I figured out there's actually a lot of cons to it and it misses out a lot of, you know, deficits.
Yeah. So the AJA score is really a way of quantifying the patient's level of neurological injury at the time. And I suppose its real merit, I suppose, in terms of actually managing patients is to see are they deteriorating. So that's one factor that we as kind of trauma clinicians are really interested in. So if the patient presents to an ED somewhere around the country and has whatever the AJA score is, and 4 hours later that score is deteriorating, that's concerning. And we may need to do more advanced imaging, MRI scans, may need to go to theater, etc. In the longer term, I suppose it gives us an idea of prognosis. So if a patient is in AJA A after 48 hours and spinal shock has resolved, to be honest with you, their prognosis is pretty guarded. The likelihood of them walking again is pretty poor. Whereas if they have an AJA B, there's a reasonable chance about 25-30% of those patients will walk again. So it's useful from a prognostication point of view. And then the other factor, I suppose, at a more long-term standpoint, and the rehab people will be able to speak to this far more in a far more detailed way than I would, it gives an idea of the care package that the patient ultimately will need. And there's distinctions, obviously, if you have a C5 level, your ability to self-care is far more compromised than if you have a C7 level. So the aids you'll need, the home supports you'll need would be greater. So on that basis, they can have some idea of what sort of financial supports, et cetera, you'd need.
Do you think, like, should emergency medicine be doing the AJA score initially or orthopedics? Because I think in some centers, it's different.
So the key thing is whoever does it is competent to do it. And, you know, oftentimes this will be the SHO or registrar in 3 o'clock in the morning. So it doesn't matter who's doing it once they're competent. The American Spine Injury Association has an online course, which you can do, I think, for $20, which, you know, if you're going through your training, it gives you a little certificate as well for your CV, but more importantly, it teaches you the clinical skills to do this in a robust, repeatable way. And it takes about 3 hours to do, I think, the course, but it takes you through it. But it's a useful skill set to have, particularly if you're pursuing a career in emergency medicine or an orthopedics, if dials it in, or neurosurgery for that matter.
I know as well the DRE has become a little bit controversial because there are some papers that are kind of coming out saying, you know, the PVR has become a little bit more sensitive to it, but I presume still every patient DRE and just include a neurological exam.
DRE is really critical to determine if the patient is complete or incomplete. So as you know, if they have no deep anal pressure, back is absent, sensation in the S2 to S4 is absent, that's a complete injury. So it's really an integral part of the AJA exam.
I suppose then if you have a patient who maybe gets an MRI, you use a TLEX score to decide whether or not clinical judgment as well, whether you're going to fix them or not. Is there anything else that you take into kind of consideration other than, you know, TLEX or a clinical situation, whether or not that patient goes for fixation?
Yeah. So the components, I suppose, are the factors we're weighing are, you know, whether there's a spinal cord injury or whether there's ongoing compression for a start. And secondly, stability. So neurological is one element we'll assess. The extent of spine stability is the second element. And I suppose the third issue would be if they've got gross deformity as well. So if the patient, for example, has a cervical spine injury, they may have a complete cord injury. Just trying to think of examples of deformity they could give you. Deformity is more likely to happen gradually, actually. Mm-hmm. So a patient who has a non-union, for example, have, you know, a kyphotic collapse down, and they'll have problems down the road in terms of trying to address that. We weigh those factors separately. So obviously patients who are unstable, the concern with those is that they're neurologically intact, but they're at risk of damaging their spinal cord. So we'll fix those patients really, I suppose, as soon as we can. But those patients are the ones that, you know, will be prioritized at a second level. Any patient who's got a spinal cord injury or neurological deficit will be prioritized over them because time is fine, really. So we'll get them up as quickly as possible. One specific group, I suppose, to mention would be ankylosing spondylitis patients or DISH patients. And they're a specific group, I suppose, to highlight to the EM community because their initial imaging may look entirely normal. Plain x-rays, it may see nothing at all. So this is kind of the man or woman who's had a fall. They may be complaining of neck pain. X-rays are reassuring. CT scan is even reassuring because obviously in these patients, the discs ossify and they now have a brittle, rigid spine. And where they fail is through the disc space. So it's often very hard to see, even on a CT scan. So for those patients, you need a really high index of suspicion and you need an MRI scan with STIR sequences to really clear them. And the implications of missing those injuries is really devastating because I think it's up to 75% of those patients, if you send them home, will return to ED with a neurological deficit. And that's irreversible. So that specific group are one to really watch. They really need to be watched carefully. It's not, we've had a number of cases over the years where they have been missed and they've been referred to us, unfortunately, after their spine's displaced.
That's almost more kind of the silver trauma side. Obviously, Angstfond, a little bit younger, but like can be trauma as well.
Patients in their 40s and 50s, you can see them, you know, so they're not like necessarily a very old age group. You know, they're walking around. They may even be unaware that they've Angstfond themselves, but you'll see in the plain x-rays, they've got the kind of classic bamboo spine or the dish pattern where they've got the multiple osteophytes running down in front of their cervical spine. So just have a high index of suspicion in those patients.
And that can be kind of minor trauma that would lead to that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Fall over, they bang their head, and next thing, you know, they've got a crack there because their spine is, say, brittle, but very rigid, and they crack through those disc spaces. So it's quite a different mechanism of injury than the standard patient. But if you think about it, let's say they have a fractured tree C5-6 in that sort of a patient. In a normal patient with normal skeletal anatomy in their cervical spine, the lever arm is just one vertebra above and below that. So the force is going through the fracture plane or less, whereas in patients with Angstfond, their entire cervical spine is fused. On top of that, they've got a 5 kilo weight at their head. So the forces displacing across the fracture site are high. And, you know, if it's missed, as I say, they're high risk of a catastrophic displacement.
Talking about C-spines there, this is kind of off-script, but C-spine collars?
Yeah, so they're kind of still standard of care in Ireland. In the UK, we stopped using them. The evidence from the literature shows that they've done cadaveric studies where they've sectioned all the ligaments in the cervical spine, and the cervical collar doesn't seem to add any actual, you know, absolute stability. So the theory is it seems to be proprioceptive feedback, that if you're awake and you're aware of this thing under your chin, you're going to keep your neck in an extended position. But in the UK, they're just using sandbags and taping. Obviously, the argument with taking them off as soon as possible is decreasing intracranial pressure, particularly for those patients who have head injuries. You know, you want to decrease intracranial pressure as quickly as possible. And in the older age group, the risk of aspiration is pretty high with the neck so extended.
You were mentioning actually about the intracranial pressure. Patients who have polytrauma as well, are we still aiming for a MAP of 85 for them to maintain spinal cord perfusion, or we're allowing permissive hypotension if they've intra-abdominal injuries or anything?
Well, again, it's back to that thing of treating the patient's life first. So if they're exsanguinating, you know, there's no point in having the patient, you know, it's going to pass away. So again, it's in a patient-by-patient basis. And in fairness, the literature, to my knowledge at least, isn't really out there in terms of arguing, you know, one way or another. But in first principles, if safe to do so, aim for a MAP of 85 to maintain cord pressure, cord perfusion, I should say.
I know we're starting to move towards the major trauma center. What do you think about in terms of primary transfer? Do you think we'll get to a point where if there's a suspected spinal cord injury, it'll be a direct to a spinal center, or will there kind of be a navigation through assessment first?
Well, certainly in the initial stages, it will be secondary transfers, as you probably know. I suppose it'll depend on the timeline. If there's a helicopter transfer from far-flung parts of the country at the moment, not in place yet. There's certainly merits in it. One of the issues in terms of trying to treat patients with spinal cord injury is to keep that MAP above 85. And even in, you know, level one trauma centers in the States, when they've looked at this, they struggle to manage this. So when the patient's going from roadside to a major trauma center, that's something that's difficult to do. It's something that's very difficult to do if the patient is transferred from the roadside to an ED around the country where they're in the resource bay, and then you're trying to give noradrenaline to maintain a MAP of above 85 in a setting where the patient potentially has other injuries. So there's certainly an argument for getting them to the primary, you know, the primary treating center as quickly as possible. But that's obviously a system-wide solution.
Yeah. When I was kind of working on spine, one of the hardest things I found, even with the transfers, was kind of having the conversation with the patient and the patient's family. And I suppose even from peripheral centers who might be setting up a transfer over to a spinal center, they have to have that conversation as well. You know, we have a suspected spinal injury, and of course the question is like prognosis and things like that. In terms of your experience, is there any advice that you'd have about starting that conversation?
Definitely, I'd say honesty is the best policy. One thing that's actually quite damaging, I think, to do is to give the patient, their family, false hope. Now, at the same time, I don't mean be incredibly pessimistic, but in the ED setting, you know, if you see a patient who has got a, inverted commas, a complete spinal injury, in all likelihood, they're in spinal shock anyway. So you're not going to be in a position to really evaluate if that's a complete cord injury or not. So, you know, it's worthwhile being honest with the patient, saying, you know, we can't really assess you because of the element of spinal shock, that you may well require something else done. And typically things evolve over time, but people in a well-meaning way in our experience often tell, or maybe it's nursing staff or whoever, tell the patients or medics, whoever, that they're going to be fine. It's all, they're going to fix you in the matter, and they arrive up to the matter expecting a miracle, and that doesn't happen. And that can often have a fairly devastating effect on the patient. So it's better to be honest with them in terms of, you know, we don't exactly know the full situation here. This looks serious. We can't evaluate you now because of spinal shock or whatever else may be going on. And to tell them the picture will evolve over time and, you know, they go to an area where the best care, I suppose, is available, but not to paint a picture that may not be the case longer term.
And that might change and evolve, I suppose. And then you might have a change in their rehab capabilities if they're going over full of hope and then they suddenly have this.
Exactly. So the long-term picture is, you know this, I'm sure, Leah, yourself, the matter. Like, the long-term picture is not even the case when they leave the matter at 10 weeks post-trauma, because there's always a delay in getting to rehab. The long-term picture is 6 or 8 months down the road. And it's very frequent that patients leave the matter and they're non-ambulatory, and 6 or 8 months later, they are ambulating. So it's a very slow recovery for those patients that are going to recover. It's really a marathon they're embarking on, as opposed to a short 3 or 4 week stint. You know, it's a year or more, at least, to get an idea of what they're going to be like long-term.
I think, you know, when, not to turn this into a very pessimistic conversation, but almost a realistic one, to kind of, for emergency medicine, to see where orthopedics are coming from and spinal centers in terms of transfers, and, you know, we're not taking that patient yet for transfer. What are some challenges that you guys face at the moment in terms of spinal trauma in Ireland, and what do you think?
Workload for a start. So it's not uncommon for us to have 7 or 8 patients waiting on our board at any one time to come in for surgery. And that's not a chronological order. They're constantly being revised in terms of priorities. So the very next patient who's waiting to come could have been waiting a week for a unstable fracture with no neurology. And next thing we're told about a patient who has an acute neurological deficit who will bump them and they'll come in straight away, and that patient will continue to wait. As well as that, I suppose, we're not just dealing with the traumas, we're dealing with a growing number of metastatic spinal tumors, which actually are a thing that you guys see very frequently in the ED as well. And this is a growing burden of our work. So we would have about 500 or 600 referrals a year of spinal metastatic tumors from around the country who are considered for surgery. And this is typically or frequently the first presentation that many of these patients have with their primary cancer. 80% of patients who have primary cancer will develop spinal metastasis, and about 10% of those will have symptomatic spinal cord compression. So this is the thing you'll frequently see in ED, where they have back pain, potentially spinal cord injury. So again, it's something to bear in mind that, you know, this may be the diagnosis behind a patient that's presenting this way.
And I think even on that note, that's actually where your Asia almost fell down, what I figured out, because it was like, you need your long tract signs, you need your clonus, you need your ataxia and stuff, which a lot of those patients present with instead, rather than the kind of vague sensory deficits and things like that. I suppose also in terms of workload, it may also be a situation on bed capacity, and then ultimately kind of rehab. I know that there are delays to rehab.
It's like a chain. So it depends on where the patient's going to from the spinal unit. Look, so we're an acute surgical center, so we're providing acute surgical care. In an ideal world, to be with us maybe 72 hours postoperatively, and then they'll go on to another center. A lot of the time that will be the referring hospital. So if the patient has no neurology, they'll go back to the referring hospital for rehabilitation and on to the local rehab center. If they do have neurology, however, and particularly spinal cord injury in the cervical spine, they will probably need to go to NRH. Depending on the facilities that are available in the referring hospital, they may not be fit to take the patient back. So the majority of these patients will need tracheostomies. They'll need weaning off the tracheostomies, or they may never actually come off the tracheostomy in older, infirm patients. So that step takes many, many months, as you know. So those patients are with us for an extended period of time. There's 9 acute beds. So we've got a number of patients with high cervical spine injuries. 3 or 4 of those beds could be occupied. So we're really working from a surgical point of view with 5 or 6 beds. From a theater capacity point of view, we have a dedicated spine theater. As the trauma center opens, we'll have a dedicated trauma operating room as well. So the spinal traumas will go into that room along with general traumas, I would anticipate. So that will increase our capacity to operate, but we'll still be left with the limited number of HGU beds that we have.
Less depressingly, what is, I suppose, the most rewarding part for you in terms of managing spinal trauma patients?
So it's getting patients, you know, when you see patients walk again, you know, after, again, it's not instant gratification, unfortunately, but when you do see them 6 or 8 months later and they're actually walking, and this is a patient who was, to all intents and purposes, paralyzed that night, that is very rewarding when it happens.
For sure. And then I suppose to wrap up, in terms of tips and tricks for emergency medicine countrywide, so every hospital, peripheral, central or otherwise, anything of particular?
So I suppose the take home message, just because people may not be aware of this, the really high index of suspicion of those ankylosing spondylitis DISH patients is one thing. I think in terms of the Asia exam, the way C4 can throw you, so when you're doing a sensory level, down over the front of the chest in this area here is C4. And people can get a little bit thrown and think it's a sensory level of T4, but it's cervical 4, not thoracic 4, just down over your collarbone. So that's one to kind of bear in mind. So that can sometimes throw the set, you know, people can be confused over the sensory level. I suppose the final thing would be the ability, if it's possible in your unit, if you do have a cord injury, typically above T6 with neurogenic shock, if the wherewithal is there to manage the patient in relation to their MAP, that's really useful. And that will typically be a noradrenaline infusion if that capacity is there, either in your ED or if you get an ICU bed. We'll obviously take that patient as quickly as we can, but that's one of the interventions that can be done immediately to try and maintain cord perfusion. Because even a level of C5 versus C6 versus C7 has huge implications for the patient from a functional point of view. So saving those individual root levels makes a huge difference in terms of the patient's independence.
We'll throw all that and the Asia things as well about C4, T4, those confusions. I'll throw that in the show notes as well so people can have access to it. Even just a link to doing that Asia, the online course. Look, thanks so much. I really appreciate you coming on. It's been really helpful just to get a different opinion on things, and we'll hope to have you back at some point.
I'd love to. Have a great evening, Lee, and thanks for your time.
I've always felt that there were many growing controversies around the management of acute spinal trauma, so I'm really glad I did get to get some answers from Professor Morris, and I hope you managed to get something out of it too, and that you could decipher my audio. We'll be releasing more content in June from our recent IMTA conference with some fascinating talks, but until then, may your coffee be strong. TCR out.